welcome to Talk is Jericho. The Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll is here. And in case you forgot,
I'm the king of the podcast world. And you're my podcast queen or king.
The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride, and it's going to be a good ride today with Samoa Joe. I love Samoa, the way that the proper pronunciation, Samoa. It's not Samoa. It is, but the real island name is Samoa Joe, who tells us all about his long 9-year career in TNA and why he finally made the decision to leave, why he went back to Ring of Honor, all of the ups and downs of a very, very successful career, and what's he going to be doing in the future. We got all of that coming up. I thank you guys for being here. I know there's hundreds of thousands of podcasts to schwaz from, and yet you schwaz mine, and I love it. And I thank you also for nominating Talk is Jericho for a podcast award. We were nominated in the Best Sports Podcast. Not sure exactly how we fit completely in the sports category, but I don't care. I'll take it because the nomination process was such a pain in the rear end. You guys had to cut and paste. You had to go to this page and go to that page. But you guys made the effort and did it, and now Talk is Jericho has been nominated for a podcast award. And what's next? Now we got to win it. And I thank you so much for helping out. And now that we've been nominated, you just got to go to podcastawards.com and vote. You can vote once a day. Winners will be revealed on April 14th in Las Vegas. It would be amazeballs to actually win a podcast award in my second year on the job. So if you dig this show, if you like being entertained by Talk is Jericho twice a week for free, baby, don't forget, this is free. I don't charge you nothing for joining me on this crazy ride, man. If you like it and you want to pay me back, go to podcastawards.com and cast your vote. Let's win this damn thing, man. Come on. Let's win this damn thing. 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 Yeah, boy. I want to win, man. You heard the big news earlier this week. It'd be big news if we won this award. It'd be just as big, even bigger than the news that we heard when Samoa Joe announced that he left TNA. The first place he came to talk about this life-changing decision, this career-defining decision, is right here on Talk is Jericho. He hasn't done any other interviews explaining his reasons for leaving TNA, but yet, what's he doing? He's here, man. That's right. We'll get into his reasons for leaving TNA. He's been there for 9 years. Some of his favorite angles and people he worked with while he was there. We'll talk about Ring of Honor, the Ring of Honor from years ago, and the Ring of Honor is now, the ups and downs of being on the road as an independent wrestler, the growth of Ring of Honor, the growth of TNA, what's he going to do in the future? So many questions to be answered by Samoa Joe. I'm excited to have him on. I'm thanking him for being on, thanking you guys for being on. I'm thanking all the sponsors of Talk is Jericho for being behind this show, the ones who allow me to do this free four times a week. Thanks all of you as well for supporting my great sponsors, including Amazon. That's right. Big thanks to you guys for doing your online shopping through my Amazon links. Easiest way to support the show, just go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Every time you use one of my Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a couple bucky wuckies to this show to help us cover production costs. I got links for the USA. I got links for the UK. I got links for the Amazon Canada. You can get all kinds of cool stuff. You can get the latest Fozzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? And right now, I'm doing this podcast from a hotel room in Belfast because last night, the Cinderblock Party Tour began with a sold-out show in Belfast, Ireland. And what a crazy show it was. Super crazy crowd, jam-packed place, hot on the stage. Not to be confused with Kiss, hot in the stage. But it was a really, really killer show. And I was a little bit scared that I wouldn't be able to make it. I was kind of almost stuck in JFK. I flew from Tampa to JFK. I landed at 6 o'clock. My flight was supposed to be at 8:30, so I went into the lounge and hung around there a bit. And you can actually order food, like gourmet food, in the lounge now, which was great. I came back out of there, went downstairs, and found out that I had been upgraded because of my Diamond Medallion status. Thank you so much, Delta, for taking care of that. I was excited, so you know, a first-class upgrade on an international flight. I had so many plans. I was going to have a drinky winky. I was going to have a bite to eat, or watch a movie, all that great stuff. So I went to the bar to celebrate by having a fine Gigi, which, as you know, is high-end vodka on ice, nothing else. And as I sat down, I saw that the flight had been delayed from 8:30 to 10:30. And it's like, okay, always a little bit suspicious to have flight delays, especially big ones like that. But what are you going to do? So I'm sitting there relaxing, and then suddenly, I guess at about 9 o'clock, that 10:30 moves to 11. And then the 11 moves to 11:30. And then the 11:30 moves to midnight. And then the bar closes. And now I'm getting a little bit scared because the flight's now delayed like 3.5 hours. And usually when something like that happens, it means they're just going to basically say, see ya, sorry, it's canceled. Now, the weather was fine. They said that the plane had already arrived and nobody knew exactly where it was. But the guy, when I asked him, said that the plane had been repoed. And I'm like, does repoed mean the same thing to you that it means to me? Because where I come from, a repoed means repossessed. You know, did somebody not pay the rent on the plane, so they took it away? You know, they start thinking, well, did the pilot lose the keys to the plane? You know, I'm sorry, guys, I can't find my keys. The flight's delayed. So then it's to 1 o'clock, and I'm thinking any moment now they're going to say that this flight has been canceled. And if it's canceled, I'm done. I missed the Belfast show because the rest of the guys were in Belfast already. I came in. I was going to be landing day of. You know, get in, go to the hotel and go for a little snooze and all that sort of thing. But, you know, the clock is ticking and I'm super scared that they're just going to announce it any time. And finally the guy comes on and goes, ladies and gentlemen, your flight is here. And it's like, yay, shows up. We ended up taking off at 2 a.m. And at that point I was so tired that I just got on the plane and crashed out. I didn't get to enjoy a drinky winky or watch a movie or even eat anything. I just fell asleep completely. We flew to Dublin. I landed there at about 2 o'clock, got picked up by my good buddy Jagger. He's got the moves like Jagger. He's got the moves like Jagger. The moves like Jagger. And he drove me to Belfast, which was a 2-hour drive. I arrived into Belfast at about 5, had a quick shower, kind of got organized, and then went to the rock show just in time for the VIP. And we killed it, man. It was a great, great show. First time for Corey Lowry joining us on bass. Corey Lowry from Stuck Mojo fame. Jeff Rouse could not do the tour because he had commitments with Duff McKagan's Loaded, which he is a founder of that band. So we had Corey join us, and it was amazeballs. He did a great job. Great player, man. Awesome, awesome player. And another fun thing was we did, for the first time ever, the song Tonight. We'd rehearsed it in Atlanta a few times, but you know, you never know what it's like until you get on the bike and get on your bike and ride and try it out and see what it's like. And we did that, and it just killed it. And you know what? I'm going to play it for you right now. From Do You Want to Start a War, played live for the first time ever in Belfast. Here's Tonight by Fozzy. We're going to live tonight like it's our last night. A doomsday party throwing caution to the wind. Our last chance to show the world just what we're made of.
Take a chance to fly. It's
what do you think? Pretty rocking tune, huh? Very, very cool. I love that chorus. Fun to sing. Crowd went nuts for it, so you can expect to hear that song in the set list from now on. And if you want to buy that song, you can do it by buying Do You Want to Start a War on Amazon.com using my links. I haven't forgotten where this all started. Don't forget, you go to podcast1.com. You click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Then you hit the Talk is Jericho button. Every time you use one of those links, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show. So you got to do that. You go to podcast1.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Then you hit the Talk is Jericho button, and you can bookmark it so you can get to those links in one easy click. Okay. Big news this week. Samoa Joe leaving TNA, and now he's on the open market. What's he going to be doing? Where is he going? What's his mindset? You're going to find out all about that.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, so we're here with Samoa Joe, and it's funny because we were going to meet here at 9 o'clock, and you got here at like 10 to 9, and I wasn't home yet.
I know.
I was like, "What kind of a pro wrestler are you? You're actually on time and early. That doesn't happen too often."
Well, like I actually sat out in front of your neighbor's house for a little bit because like he has these like really proud pontificated lion statues in the lawn. I'm like, "Oh, look at this egomaniac. Look at this guy.
My neighbor's nuts. She'll, and I hope she doesn't listen to this, which I don't think she does, but she cleans every day.
Yeah.
And she wears the same outfit every day. She's out there. Like if it's raining out, she's sweeping the rain down the driveway. Like one of those type of kind of really strange mental issue type people.
I got a neighbor like that too. I can't really
tell. Yeah. Did you, I mean, are you just always kind of an early person?
It's not so much I'm an early person. It's that I'm like a 5 hours of sleep person. Like my dad was, I was, and like, you know, like my dad, we had like a Polynesian show. So like my dad, like he'd work at Western Airlines in the morning. He'd start at 5. He'd get done at 3, then he'd go to Disneyland. He'd do like 5 shows a night.
You said he had a Polynesian show?
Yeah, our family had a big Polynesian show. So.
Oh, like with the fire and
yeah,
everything
fire
like that?
Yeah, fire and dance.
Oh, no
Hula
kidding.
Dancers, my whole 9 yards, dude. So we toured a bunch. And like, my dad, he'd go down to Disney, do 5 shows a night at the Tejan Terrace, come home 10:30, and then he'd be up at like 5 again to head back to LAX. So it was like, I don't know, we've all kind of kept like really crazy short hours.
I was talking about actually being like early. Like, you know, the Japanese style. Like,
yeah,
I remember
the
first time I started working for Tenru's group, I came down to the lobby at, you know, 10 o'clock. Lobby was 10 o'clock, and Asai, Ultimo Dragon, took me inside. I said, "You're late." I said, "What's 10 o'clock? He said, "No, 10 o'clock means 9:30.
Yeah.
And you spent a lot of time in Japan.
Yeah,
so
man,
did you like, kind of have that instilled in you there, too?
Yeah, like, you know, just like the first, like, maybe, like, 2 or 3 years. No, yeah, about first 2 or 3 years of my career. Did a lot of time over there. I spent a lot of time over there. And yeah, man, they're real punctual and stuff. But at the same time, like, it's different because you get it back over there. You know what I mean? Like, they're always on time with everything. They're always, you know, Johnny on the spot whenever you need something. So it's kind of like it reciprocates, dude. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's all good.
I always like that kind of it's very meticulous. Like you said, it's very machine-like, as in you be here at this time and you show up at this time. And if you do that, it's the easiest place in the world to work. If you show up on time and don't do stupid, you can stay there forever.
Yeah. The first part I think is easy. The second part I can't really speak to. But the first part's definitely easy.
The first thing I ever was told, I went over there with FMW.
Uh-huh.
And it was myself and Lance Storm. And we were just super green, like maybe a year.
Dude, Lance Storm had the sweetest ducktail, by the way.
We talked about that a couple weeks ago on this show. And he said he was trying to emulate Sting.
Yeah, it was awesome, though.
He said it wasn't a rat tail. He said it was a
ducktail. A little wider. Yeah, rat tails are small and they're inconsequential. That thing makes a statement.
But they said, I remember Mark Starr, he's passed away since. He said, when you go to a Japanese, when you check into the hotel, always grab a business card,
because
that way you'll
card.
Always know where you are.
Like, yeah.
Because if you get lost somewhere, how are you supposed to find your way back?
And even if you do know like the name and address of the place, like you're going to butcher the name and like the cab driver's going to look at you like an idiot the whole time. So yeah, it's worth it.
Yeah. Cause those people, they're very meticulous. Once again, is that word. Like if someone said to you, like, I remember I went to like a truck stop, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to get hot cakes.
Yeah.
And I said to the guy, hot cake. And he didn't know what I was saying. Hot cake. He didn't know what I was saying. So then I got the referee to ask. And it's like, hot cake.
Yeah.
Okay. Like if somebody.
Hot cake. Okay.
Now if someone came up to you and you're working in a restaurant that serves hot cakes. Yeah. Hot cake. You'd go, okay, this guy wants hot cakes.
Yeah.
But reverse, it didn't work that way.
No, you got to get it right. You want to make sure. Right.
So you've been in the news over the last couple of weeks because after, I don't know how, 10 years or so?
Yeah, nine years.
9 years, you decided to take take the plunge or whatever it would be and leave TNA to go to, I guess, other places, greener pastures or whatever it may be. What prompted this decision? Because you're one of the guys that was a cornerstone of TNA for so long, and also one of the guys that was one of the biggest stars, and also kind of for a few years, kind of one of the forgotten stars, kind of on the back burner for a while. What went down over the last few months, Joe?
It was, you know, I think the lead up to it. I mean, it really, I can't even say it was the last few months, dude. You know, it was a little bit. First and foremost, like I think one of the perceptions that a lot of fans have about wrestlers is that, you know, you can up and leave anytime you want and you can like whatever. No, I signed a contract and I believe in honoring your deals and stuff. And, you know, over the course of my last deal and even before that, you know, there was just a accumulation of smaller issues and some bigger issues. But, you know, at the end of it all, you know, I kind of looked around and realized, you know, this is what I've accomplished in TNA. I don't think there's much more I can do within the bounds of the company. And, you know, I'm a bit ambitious and I want a bit more. You know?
Was it hard to leave after, like you said, being there for 9 years?
Absolutely. Because, I mean, in nine years where I was invested too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it'd be different if it was like I was there for 9 years and it was what it was. And but not like I generally, you know, I still keep in touch with and care about a lot of the guys I worked with. And as you know, like, you know, pro wrestling is a big family and you always see each other somewhere down the line in your highs and your lows. But, you know, it's, yeah, it was extremely tough, man. But, you know, it was funny. There was a series of events kind of towards the end there where I kind of looked around and it was kind of air apparent and clear to me, man. It was time to move on.
What were some of those events that you're referring to?
I think the biggest one was just, you know, a few subtle disagreements between me and management and how they're viewing me. And there's, you know, some other comments too that kind of made me realize that maybe they were moving in a different direction creatively, and which is fine. I mean, it's not something I'm like, well, you know, to hell with them. I mean, you know, you all have to make your decisions. And after kind of taking those incidents into account and taking into account things they've done with me on the creative end and some other issues business wise between us, you know, I just realized, you know, maybe it's better for both of us if I moved on.
Well, you know, it's interesting because back in the, you know, in the old days or whatever, you'd go to a company, a territory, you'd stay for a year, 2 years or 3 years. And that's a long time. But when you say 9 years, I mean, that is a long run in a company, you know, so there is a lot of chance to get overlooked or stagnant, or like you said, maybe it's just time to, because the key to wrestling, as you know, is always constantly influx of new talent.
Absolutely. And I think the stagnation is probably another big issue too, is that, you know, I felt a lot of times they just, you know, they had trouble kind of figuring out what they wanted to do with me. And, you know, they liked me and they were very, very receptive to me and stuff. But at the same time, you know, it comes to a point where, you know, words only go so far and you start reading more into actions. And, you know, I just kind of, it really helped along the decision.
You know, sometimes people, well, it happens for all wrestling fans because, you know, wrestling fans are, and wrestling critics and wrestling pundits.
Oh, yeah.
They want to pile on to, you know, the booking of the WWE or TNA as a company. But you have been there in TNA and really helped grow this company because say what you want about it, it's an internationally touring company with a lot of positives, and of course there's negatives as well, but how did you feel about the growth of TNA over the years? Because a lot of it was on your back and on AJ's back as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that was a personal point of pride, I think, for especially me, AJ, you know, Daniels, a lot of guys who'd started with the company because, you know, when I first started with Ring of Honor, that was something that we grew. I mean, you know, it was put on the backs of me and several other guys, and we grew that company. And it was something that, and being a part of that process is awesome. You know, it's something that a lot of wrestlers don't get a chance to be a part of actually growing and being at the bedrock of a company. I had that opportunity with ROH. I have that opportunity with TNA. And, I mean, it's just, you know, it's awesome. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I think at points, you know, and business is business, and I don't hold any personal fault to anybody. You know, people forget, you know, especially in the office, and you know, they're invested in various other ways. And don't get me wrong, she works herself to the bone, and she's invested a lot of her money, a lot of her family's money, into making TNA a viable brand in the international market. And I don't fault her for that at all. But at the same time, you know, you look around and you realize that maybe at the end of 9 years, the amount of appreciation that you would hope for and from the company maybe isn't quite there, and they might view you in a different light than you feel you should be viewed. And I think at that point the relationship starts to get poisonous.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that to happen with me and TNA. I didn't want to be there and feel like and have this growing resentment inside of me, and that was another major factor. Is I don't really believe in sitting around and waiting for things to get that bad between you and a company. And you know, I'd rather kind of pull myself away, take that energy that it would be consumed with these negative feelings, and have that pushed into something positive. And that was a big reason why I ended up leaving.
You know, I went through the same thing in 2005 in the WWE. I was getting real burned out, real stagnant. Things that used to come very easy to me as far as putting together a match, I would have to think longer. I was starting to get disgruntled. And I always remember, and they're really good guys now, but at the time, you know, the member, like, for example, Hall and Nash and WCW, just complaining about everything and bitching about everything.
Yeah. And as you know, there's like that guy in every company, but
that's, I mean, right.
Yeah, but it's like one of those things. That's the second battle that you have to have,
right?
Is fighting the environmental negativity that's around you. And there's always one or two or 15 of those guys, you know, in every company that you go to.
Yeah,
that's there.
But I didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah,
right. Then that's what you're saying too. You didn't want to be that guy who's poisoned and bitter and just
because it's
bearing
bad.
Everything.
It's bad for everybody.
It's bad for everyone. So I left. You know, I took myself out of the game and left before it could get that way. And sometimes you have to do that. Professionally, personally,
because
then you start getting bitter at home.
You know? It infects everything. And I didn't want that. And like I said, I saw that too, you know, well before, you know, this. I mean, you know, you see those guys and you're like, how can you exist like that, man? Like, it's just so horrible, you know? And I definitely didn't want that to happen with me, you know?
When you first came into TNA, and I remember, I don't know if probably Twitter wasn't around, but my website or something like that. When you first came on, I was like, this is my new favorite guy, because you were just kicking the crap out of everybody in a good way, like, not for real, just looking like it. Like, I've always said, I said this the other day to somebody, I was talking to Daniel Bryan about how I've never met a Samoan who wasn't a good worker and who couldn't drink like a mofo. But I don't know what it is about, you know, you talk about the bad side of racial profiling, but this is the good side. If you're a Samoan and you're in the wrestling business, you're good. Yeah. That's just the way it is. And I don't know what it is about your people, but you guys are always good, and it's so hard hitting work, very crisp, very strong style, very tight. Are you part of the family with anybody at all?
I'm not a part of the Onaway family. And it's funny because before Ecky passed, we had a meeting. You know, we met at WrestleMania, and he was hot.
With Umaga?
And Umaga. And he said, oh, somebody from my family said you something about my family. And he goes, you want to step outside? And I was like, yeah, step outside. And like, Samoans is different. Like, you know, it's like, step outside. If a guy meets you head on, it's not like, okay, well, if this guy's willing to meet me head on and talk it out, then usually there's more to this. So we walked outside and we talked and had a great discussion, man. And, you know, kind of cleared up a lot. And like, you know, I said, you know, like, I'm not a part of the Onaway family, you know, but if you ask my aunt, and my uncle, they can sit there for 5 minutes and they'll put the connection together, and I will be, but, and that's all Samoans. That's another, that's, I guess, positive stereotype. We're all related. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And, so, I mean, you know, and I didn't, coming up through the business, everybody constantly wanted to say, oh, you know, are you an Onaway? Are you an Onaway?
Or a Fatu.
Right. Yeah. And I thought it would be, my via, you know, and I thought it'd be disrespectful if I aped off of their name. I mean, that's their family, dude. That's their blood. And they've paved the way. Mm-hmm. No doubt. I mean, they have paved the way for all Polynesian wrestlers, not just Samoan, Polynesian wrestlers in general, to come into the business. Mm-hmm. I mean, before, you know, High Chief Peter Maivia, nobody even knew where Samoa was.
Right, yeah.
It's the truth. You know, and most Americans outside of, you know, avid football fans probably wouldn't know who Samoans were, because, you know, other than the big guys that block and tackle on the front lines, you know. So, you know, I was always cognizant not to try to ape off of their family's success. Mm-hmm. That being said, like, man, what a legacy that family has, dude. You know, I know Kishi's won the Hall of Fame now, and that's like,
yeah, well, crazy. That's what I'm saying, like the Anoa'is and the Fatus, you know, and we talk about the Maivias as well. I mean, there's such a grand Samoan tradition, but they all fall into those categories. You're like, I don't even know what your last, what is your last
name? Sanoa. I'm a
Sanoa. Okay, yeah. So you have your kind of your own family.
And that's the other thing too, is that I'm proud of my family, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I'm proud of, you know, my family and Nu'ili and where they come from, and it's like, you know, I didn't want to get it all twisted up, and honestly, like some of it was just like I wanted to earn my reputation on my own back, and I didn't
Makes perfect sense. But it's like for me coming through the Calgary system,
yeah,
like there's a real
you're not a heart,
Lionheart,
yeah.
But I mean that there was a real sense of pride to go through the Calgary system, and then Japan, they'd even have a name for us. We were called the Calgary Kids. Mm-hmm. So if you come from Calgary and you're the shits.
Yeah,
that's even worse.
Yeah,
did you feel a little bit of pressure or like lineage, as in, okay, I'm coming from this Samoan background, I gotta be good for.
It was funny, I did it, but it was because, especially when I started in the Indies, and you being a Samoan and that perception of all Samoans being good workers, it was like
yeah,
people kind of treated me in a different light. You know, they were like, oh, hey, Samoan kid. Oh, yeah, yeah. Bring him. Yeah, yeah. He's booked. Yeah, bring him on down. Yeah, so, yeah. He can work, right? Yeah, they can all work. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Fine. Yeah,
they
so,
can all work.
Yeah, so it actually helped me a little bit. And yeah, I never felt any overwhelming pressure. If anything, even when I see those guys today, man, it's always overwhelming support and stuff like that. So it's cool.
But there is a style that you guys have. Like I said, like a Calgary style. I don't know why, but all Calgarians hit the turnbuckle better than anybody else. Like, they say, shoot me and give me a turnbuckle. Uh-huh. It's just great. Mm-hmm. Samoans, there's a style of like so crisp and strong style. And like I said, like Eki, for example, Umaga, one of my favorite guys to work against and to watch. And Rikishi too.
Yeah.
Because everything looked like he was killing the guy, but it was light as a feather. And you're the same. We've never worked, but I'm assuming it's the same.
I hope so. you know, I think it has a lot to do with the upbringing. You know, Samoans will make no bones about it. It's a very physical household. You know what I mean? And not an abusive household by any stretch. I mean, there's a lot of love. But, I mean, when things go wrong, you know about it right away. You know what I mean? And that's every Samoan. And it's not just your parents, too. It's like, you know, everybody in the family has free reign on you. So if you're messing up in front of your uncle, expect to catch that same backhand that you get at home in front of your mom and dad. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. I think a lot of times when guys come into pro wrestling and they start, you know, I remember kind of taking my first bumps and getting knocked around a little bit and chopped around and stuff. And me kind of going, well, you know, this is, I'm not saying it's not, didn't hurt, but it was just like, it wasn't unusual or uncommon to me. You know what I mean?
And, yeah.
And as far as like the crispness and the style, I mean, you know, I mean, Samoans really value like having a physical household and their kids, you know, your kids play sports, they often don't have the grades to probably go faster because we're, you know, we like to party and have fun too. But, you know, it's just, you know, kind of the physicality and stuff like that. It's kind of drilled into you from when you're a kid.
So when you came up through the ROH system and you're making the decision to go to TNA, because you had a big, big buzz about you from Ring of Honor. There was a lot of you guys there at the time. Mm-hmm. I say you guys, the same kind of like with us with the ECW buzz, mm-hmm. where there's a national promotion, but it's still under the radar, but you're hearing about Samoa Joe, you're hearing about AJ Styles and CM Punk and Bryan Danielson and you know, whoever else was there at the time. Did you ever consider going to WWE? Did you have an opportunity and kind of made the choice for TNA, or was TNA the one that kind of came to you earliest?
TNA actually, when I was in ROH, TNA had actually made a couple initial offers to me earlier that they just didn't work out. You know, it just wasn't smart on either of our ends. And then when they were transitioning to Spike before they had the TV deal, they had asked me to come in just for a few dates. So I was actually working jointly ROH and TNA for probably my first half a year, maybe a year and a half, not entirely sure, that I was with TNA. So, I mean, it really wasn't... It was such a smooth transition because it was like I was up there, I could still go back and work ROH dates, and then eventually TNA offered me a deal that, you know, that we liked, and you know, that was exclusively TNA. Mm-hmm. So it was a really, really smooth transition. So that's why, like, this point in my life, it's kind of weird because I've never done the whole like free agency thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like they're calling it. I don't know, but like, so unemployed, whatever. Like, you know, like, so it is kind of weird now, but, I mean, it just kind of like evolved into TNA, you know what I mean? It wasn't really a, you know, it's do or die time. Here we go. It was kind of like, well, you know, I guess here's where we're at. So yeah. let's keep the.
It's interesting going. When you say that. It's like if it's been 9 years, that's pretty much like your adult, quote unquote, life.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
As a career, yep. has been in TNA. When you first came to TNA, what was their TV situation?
They was non-existent.
Oh.
Yeah, it was. And to quote Scott D'Amore, who I love to death, he's like, listen, you're a big internet guy. We're doing this stuff on the internet, so we're going to bring you in for a few shots. And I was like, oh, thanks, Scott. Appreciate it, man. And,
yeah, because they were doing pay-per-views yeah, for a while with yeah, no TV.
With no TV, and it was just strictly iPay-per-view.
Yeah.
I might have had an inkling from a friend. You know, I was living in LA at the time and keep good contacts out there. Might have had an inkling from a friend that the Spike deal was going through. So.
Oh, okay. So it was right before the Spike deal.
Yeah, and I think it was pretty shortly thereafter I came to the company that they started on Spike.
Do you remember who the champ was when you came in? Was it Kurt?
Kurt wasn't there yet. It was probably like Jeff or.
So this was before Angle even came
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah. Angle. Yeah, this is. I was even Christian before he even came in, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, like I said, I was watching TNA when you came in there, mm-hmm. and then it's like, whenever I think of you in TNA, I think of you in Angle. Because that was the big build, right? Yeah, like, was it like 6 months or 8 months?
No, it wasn't that long, unfortunately. Okay. We wanted it to be. Me and Kurt both, we really wanted it to be. But they wanted to, they wanted to fire it off and get it started a little bit sooner. So
when he came in, you were his first opponent.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
How did you like working with Kurt?
I loved it, and I still do. I mean, Kurt's one of those guys who, he's just good. I mean, he can, no matter how hurt he is, no matter, you know, how healthy he is, whatever, I mean, he somehow that switch turns in him, and he gets out there, and he's ready to go. So, I mean,
true performer, awesome. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, Kurt, for all that Kurt's accomplished, he's still one of those guys that the thought of phoning it in just appalls him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, he gets, you know, he gets mad, or, like, I've seen him, like, if he hears a comment, like, oh, you know, Kurt ain't what he used to be. Well, we're going crazy tonight. I don't care. 25 minutes. We're going to show him. Yeah, we're going to show him, Kurt. You know, like, you know, he definitely takes care of his reputation.
I call him a thumb because he's a face on a neck. You could draw a face on a thumb and that's him.
I didn't know where his head started. I like his chin and his Adam's apple. I keep getting him confused. Like, he's just...
He was like that from the start, though. Like, even when he first came into the WWE, like right off the bat, he was. I remember working with him. He maybe was there 6 months, and you're having, you know, the quote unquote 4 or 5 star matches, working main events on, you know, if there's a split crew for house shows, you know, him and I worked main event on whatever it was, the B show, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And this is 6 months into his tenure. Like, he is just a naturally great performer who just got better and better and better. I think, and it's a strange thing to think about because TNA and WWE are so different, but I think some of his best performances and some of his best years were spent in TNA for sure.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, when you come from WWE, obviously, Kurt, he didn't want to have anybody say, oh, you know, it's... He's taking a step back or whatever like that. Like,
it's a demotion.
He took it to heart and he wanted to show the world that he was still.
But that was a huge get. Like, you come in.
Huge get.
He comes in right after. You mentioned Christian's in there after. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of momentum and steam going on at that point in time.
A ton. And I mean, the company was really, really, I mean, to use a cliche, it was firing on all cylinders. You had a really good collection of really great, and especially seasoned guys who knew how to, you know, elicit what they wanted to from a crowd. And then you combine it with guys who were, you know, younger, rawer talent that, you know, it kind of shaped and honed a lot of guys, me, myself included, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just, it was a really invaluable experience.
Talk is Jericho.
So we're here with Samoa Joe. Let's talk a little bit about the booking team and the creative team in TNA. It's something that I don't even know who it is. I mean, WWE, obviously, it's Vince, and Triple H is in there, and they've got Ed Koski and Dave Kapoor, et cetera, et cetera. When you were talking about this time when TNA was firing all cylinders, who was the creative team at that point in time?
It changed so much all the time. It was hard to say. I think Jeff... Initially, Jeff, and then Jeff had a committee of him, Dutch Mantel. I know I'm leaving tons of people out.
But if you're talking about kind of the Jarrett Mantel, that's a good kind of cornerstone.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good Southern type guys who have been around for a long time booking in the classic traditional
way. And I give Jeff a lot of credit because, like, he also – despite whatever he would have felt creatively about somebody, he also understood a guy who drew and was getting a reaction, and he was very, very responsive to it and would do his
best. If you're feeling something, you mean?
Yeah, if you're feeling something. Like, he wouldn't ignore it, you know what I mean?
Right.
He or try to change the perception. He would be like, well, you know, the wave's rolling, let's start riding it, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so, I mean, and that was cool in respect. Russo, I think, towards the 08, 09, but he was working in conjunction with a lot of people, Jeff and all that. And then, you know, you had Bischoff and Hogan come in. And
how was it when those guys came in?
When they first came in, Hulk was, Hulk's Hulk. He's a real cool, chill dude. And he just wanted to come in and help out and do what he could. You know, Bischoff's a real visionary cat. You know, he kind of comes in and he has this air about him, like, you know, we're going to change the world. And, my meetings with them, I mean, and when I worked with them, it was always cool. I mean, there was a little discrepancy in there where I disappeared for a while and I came back and it wasn't explained. And everybody to this day still points fingers at everybody else over that. But
like, creatively you disappeared or like,
no, like literally
for real,
I was thrown in a van and carted off. And then there was no explanation why I disappeared back on TV again. And it's funny, 'cause even to this day, everybody, like, I've talked to several Russo and Vance and everybody else, and nobody really kind of like, well, just, you know, we don't know.
We just went to get some milk and cigarettes.
Yeah. Oh, just my crazy college buddies.
Yeah. And my last weekend.
We partied in Cabo. It was great.
So what do you think was the peak of TNA as a company?
I'm so horrible with dates, so it's hard to say.
But I mean, I'm talking about like...
I think the stuff with me and Kurt, I think, was a real peak for the company. I think
that's you guys like drew some buy rates.
Yeah, we did really matches. Good buy rates. Probably the best that the company ever had. And but I mean, it was an extension of what people really, really were into. Because at the time, like I said, I had this buzz coming up from Ring of Honor and stuff like that. And obviously, Kurt had his pedigree, which was just fantastic at the time. And Kurt, you know, he really, really, it was funny when Kurt got to TNA, the first thing, he's like, I can't wait to get in the ring with you. And, you know, he was all about it. And, I think for me, I mean, it sounds a little bit self-edifying, but I think that was kind of the height of the company and the peak of the company.
Well, and I think another reason too is around that time was when, now there's a lot of hybrid guys of wrestling and kind of MMA, more of a, I hate to use the word shoot style, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just you're seeing a lot of MMA technique kind of crossing into pro wrestling, because now the general populace understands.
Yes.
Like, I think when you went back to the early 90s, like a Kimura or, you know, chicken wing lock, you know, guys would be like, oh, that's a lame move. But now you're seeing guys get their arms snapped with it on Friday nights, you know, at UFC.
You know it works.
And now guys are like, well, that's all, yeah, Kimura's all day, they're the best. So, you know, and straight arm bars. You know, it's funny, you go back to the, you know, early 90s and the 80s, and guys would get a straight arm bar, somebody's like, why is he humping his elbow? And now, like,
right,
you see an arm bar, and you're like, oh, it's going to snap, it's crazy. So, you know.
It bothers me, and I learned this in Japan probably in 95, 96. Mm-hmm. Someone puts the arm bar on, you have to try and lock it.
Yeah, lock your hands,
with
right?
Your hands.
Yeah, I'm a big stickler for that too.
Yes,
I hate dudes who just sit there in it for like.
Yeah, guys won't lock their hands, and like you said, they really are just humping the elbow. And it's like, if this was real, you'd be snapped in a second.
Yeah.
The only chance you have is to lock.
And like,
hands.
I've even caught like cross arm breakers on guys, and guys kind of leave their arm out there, and the whole time sit there going, I really want to pump this elbow, but you're cool. But I really want to pump this elbow because you're sitting here,
I'll teach you a lesson,
giving me the sleeper cell and trying to clap up the crowd.
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to break your arm right now. What are you doing?
Raise my hand.
Yeah.
Raise it again. But you know, you and Kurt. My point was that was you and Kurt were working a style that was one of the first kind of hybrid wrestling with, you know, this MMA amateur wrestling kind of shoot style.
And honestly, I'd love to see it kind of infect the product more, because I think. You know, I think you can probably attest this better than anybody. You know, you always have that salty old guy who's like, ah, work a hold, kid. Ah. And, you know, in a way, you know, sometimes they work it too much or it's ridiculous. But in other ways, I think that the submission aspect of wrestling, I'd love to see it become more prominent. You know what I mean? Like, slams, the high flying. I mean, I think the high flying's kind of reached a level that is unparalleled. Now some guys are doing this amazing stuff. But at the same time, I think that the danger and the absolute, like, you know, peril that you see in a good submission match when guys are just locked up and they're looking, you know, for doors and windows to get out and escape.
Right.
It's like, you know, nothing really compares to that type of excitement. And I've seen a little bit, I've seen it in Japan, obviously. And you even see it in MMA today, but I think it's a style that's going to like kind of permeate the sport within the coming years.
I mean, you're really good at that. Did you train in that?
I was a judo kid. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, you know, that was kind of my thing. And then after that, kind of coming up through the business, you know, I ran into a lot of good jiu-jitsu guys, and they would give me pointers to work out with them. And then going over to Japan, obviously, it's very, very much ingrained in the culture there. And I had the wonderful opportunity of working underneath Fujiwara, and like, you know, him kind of just, you know, taking the time with me and just showing me different things and old hook and shoot techniques and catching people in shin locks and just nasty, nasty stuff. And it's just like, you know, it's like after kind of going through that experience, it's like, yeah, man, I love this. I'd like to see this more, you know, to the forefront.
I always loved when you see a picture of Fujiwara. First of all, he's looked the same for about 30 years.
Yeah, he doesn't age.
And he looks like a skinny, fat guy, old guy.
Yeah.
But he could tear all of our arms off.
He can tear everybody's thumbs off. He's the dirtiest, meanest old man you'll ever see.
Who did you work for when you went to Japan?
I started with 01 under Hashimoto. It was Hashimoto's offshoot company.
Right.
And
did you ever work with Hashimoto?
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities between you guys.
I mean, he was a real big influence to me too. I mean, this is a guy who was the Japanese Elvis in his latter years, you know.
But
you know, he could arrest the crowd's attention like nobody else. And, you know, he'd always talk about, he's like, the eyes. It's all in the eyes.
In the eyes.
Yeah, in the eyes. He's like, you know, this is like, he's like, you know, intention, you know, aggression, anger, it all comes from the eyes, you know, and people know and they see it. And, you know, he'd come in that ring, and I mean, you know, if you saw him walking down the street, you'd be like, oh, he's the happiest, jolliest guy in the world. And then he'd walk in that ring and be like the destroyer of worlds. And it was just,
oh yeah.
He was a real big influence on me.
I've never been kicked harder by anybody than by Hashimoto.
Oh, me either.
Kicked to the breadbasket as hard as he could.
I mean, he was trying to make your heart come out the back of your.
Yeah. And like Joe's saying, he Japanese Elvis, and that he resembled Elvis in body type, you know, 77 Elvis as well. He was a portly guy, chubby, but man, was he ever tough.
Yeah. And he could go. That was the thing that killed me too. Yeah. Is that like you would think, oh no, this guy can't go, you know, like he's just kind of like cruising, and he wouldn't. He'd go in there and he'd bust his ass and he'd go crazy. And just
were
like,
you friends with him?
Yeah, I was. And he was awesome. He was an awesome boss to have, and he was, I mean, really, really kind. And I mean, he, you know, if I remember at the time me kind of going, you know, I'd like to stay in Japan, you know, between tours, and you know, Trey and I was young and didn't have anything really better to do party.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd like to stay and I'd like to learn and stuff. And like, you know, he put me up. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. And said, yeah, you come stay and no big deal. And I mean, he'd do that all the time.
He passed away 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it kind of unexplained circumstances, or did he have?
No, I mean, I think it was legit. I think he just had some medical condition. I think
cancer or something. Yeah,
aneurysm
maybe?
Or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was just, and unexplained circumstances in Japan usually means, there was a debt that needed to be collected. And,
kind of yakuza issues.
Yeah.
But Japanese are strange, though. Like, I know whenever you have, like, if somebody has cancer, or they don't ever talk about never release it. It's almost like a dishonorable thing.
Well, it would be perceived as the leadership of the company being weakened.
Weak, right.
And they don't want anything, you know, and they very much live for their company and for the perception of everything. So like, he did not want to see 01 seen in that light, that, oh, well, they got a lame duck, you know, boss.
Yeah. If the boss has legitimate health issues, he's weak, and the company will be weak too.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. A strange land.
Strange, man. Strange, wonderful place.
Where else did you work after 01?
And then by that time I had just started up with Ring of Honor and was working to stateside.
But have you never worked All Japan or New Japan? I thought you
had. Noah.
Oh, Noah. Noah. Okay.
But that was later on. That was actually during my tenure in TNA. You know, we had a decent relationship with Noah, and when Kobashi had come over and wrestled me in ROH, me and the Noah office hit it off really, really well. And they wanted to use me full time, but at the time I had signed a deal with TNA.
That was another great match, Kobashi and Samoa Joe.
Yeah,
that's another similar type of guy, a big, agile guy like yourself, strong style.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy working with him?
Oh, absolutely. And it was funny because, you know, the Noah guys had no idea how much of a following, you know, especially with the Ring of Honor fans and the hardcore, you know, watch everything pro wrestling fans that they had out here.
Because you're bringing those guys over here to work in New York City or whatever.
All the hotbeds. So, I mean, they're expecting to come over and get this kind of like really xenophobic response.
Throw
like,
salt, bow.
And it was funny. Like, they actually had this idea in their mind that they were going to come over here to the States and like, you know, they were going to treat Kobashi like he was Mr. Fuji. And I'm trying to explain to him, you know, kind of previous to the event, I'm like, no, everybody here knows it. He goes, oh, then maybe, and, you know, and he's kind of kind of setting up some hokey stuff, very like yeah. salt in the eyes, you know, like type of deal.
I bow
Should
to
I
you.
Bring my translator out and say I hate America? No.
Spit green mist.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there and I'm going, no. All these people know you. They know everything you do. And in my broken English and the translators, I'm broken Japanese and the translator's helping me. And he's like, oh, really? Yeah. Trust me. They're going to, you just do everything you normally do and then you'll be fine. And then he comes out through the crowd. I remember he gets this monster ovation and they're throwing streamers and they're going crazy. And he just like, I remember he gets to the ring of the initiative and kind of give me this look, the sideways look like, oh, wow, I guess, wow, okay. All right.
You know, right, yeah.
This won't be so bad as I thought it would be.
Was he easy to put together a match with?
Yeah. And most of the Japanese guys are because it's not a real meticulous process. Like they have their ideas of what they want to do and like, you know, get to this point. And then what's in between is just like, you know, we're just going to go and we feel it and we work off of each other.
I'm sure there's a trust factor too. I mean, he knows he's coming over here to work with you.
Yeah.
It's not somebody that he doesn't know.
Yeah. And when they had brought guys over previous and I had worked in Japan pretty extensively and I'd been on joint shows between Noah and Zero One. So he knew of my work. He knew of me and he knew I understood their style.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty easy process.
That's great. It's funny you mentioned throwing streamers. I think that now people throw more streamers in the States at Ring of Honor
they do
shows
than in Japan. Yeah.
They rarely do it there, but here people think, oh, they just throw streamers in Japan. It's like, Not really.
It was only for real special. Oh, well, you know, keep doing your thing, guys. You know?
Did you, are you the first guy that you ever saw doing the Muscle Buster? Did you invent that or did you
nick it
from somebody?
No, I nicked it, bro. That's stolen, not mine.
Everybody's stolen it.
It was funny. I saw one guy and he works for Noah named Muhammad Yoni. He used it, but he used to go to his.
Was he a gaijin? Was he a foreign guy or was he a Japanese guy?
He was a Japanese guy, but he just had, I know. Muhammad.
Yeah. Muhammad.
And he had an Afro, which was, I thought was pretty cool. So, I saw him do it once, but he used to go to just sit down to his butt with it. And immediately I'm like, oh my God, that has to crush your spine. And,
imagine the pressure of that.
Yeah. So I was just like, I don't think that's going to work. So then I modified it a bit and I thought, well, you know, let's just bring it to the ground. I think it looks a little bit nicer and, you know, compact guy a little bit more. But I mean, originally I was actually sitting in the dojo in one of my stayovers and they had an like Ultimate Muscle, like manga sitting there. And I'm watching Thinum and I saw the move in there and I was like, I wonder if he could do that for real. And then that's when I saw Yoni do it. And I said, I want to change up a little bit, put a little more impact on it. So then I started bringing it down to my back and that's how
it's a great move. And it's one of those ones that no one else has really done as far as.
And I think that was my biggest thing is that nobody in the States was really doing it.
Yeah.
And, I was relatively sure I could get most people in it, so.
But nobody has stolen it. Like, you know, no one uses it in WWE that I know
Cody,
of.
Cody was using it for a little bit.
Oh, Cody was?
But to his credit, and he's a real solid dude, you know, texted me and said, hey, man, no offense. I was like, dude, totally cool. No offense taken. Not at all, you know.
He didn't last very long, though.
I think he switched to something else. I don't know, you know.
Well, that's the thing about a finish like that. You got to be really strong to do that. You know, and Cody doesn't have the same build as you have with the big legs. I mean, can see you be able to hold guys like that, you know.
I saw him do it a couple times. I didn't see him do it after that. But, you know.
Who else did you enjoy working with in TNA?
Christian, when he was there, he was awesome. That's no surprise. Yeah. I mean, honestly, you talk to anybody, they'll say the same thing. AJ was, and you know this. You have that guy that, like, when you work him, you don't even want to talk to him or look at him until you're in the ring. And I mean, that's AJ.
You don't have to.
No, you don't have to, and you know it's going to be good. And it's like if. I remember, you know, just tons of times walking into a building and seeing my name next to AJ's. And, like, first of all, you look at each other disgusted for no other reason other than, all right. And then you don't talk all day. And then you go, well, what are we going to do tonight? I don't know. What did we do 2 months ago? Well, I know we can't do that. Well, let's change it up a little bit. And then that's literally all you say to each other. And then you go in and do
it. It's the best when you have that chemistry.
Yeah.
You know?
Chris Daniels, but I've known him forever, and it's the same thing with him.
He kind of had a group of guys that all came in from Ring of Honor
and
in
the same area.
Together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we all kind of came together, and it worked out great. And I mean, most recently, Bobby Roode,
very underrated.
Oh man, yeah. I mean, and you know, I think a lot of times, you know, as a fan, you don't understand the nuances of how good a person is. And Bobby Roode is one of those guys who's just out of this world. I mean, just he will get something great out of anybody that you put him in there with. And I think, I mean, he's just awesome.
I remember him coming to WWE tryouts for, I'm not going to say years, but it was, must have been 4 or 5 times you see him around, because he was friends with Val Venus.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him. He's like, you know, I'm getting an offer from TNA, and WWE says, well, maybe I should, you know, try to come back again next time with a mask. And I was like, dude, you got to go because you're not going to get a shot here. And he went over to TNA and just killed it. Like, killed it. Like, like you said, the cornerstone almost of the promotion.
No, and I mean, they are a better company for him. I mean, I mean, he's just, and he's one of those talents that's so versatile, and he can go in there and get down with anybody. And I mean, like I said, he's an unsung hero over there.
How did you feel, I guess it's been about a year, when AJ left?
I was heartbroken, man. You know, like, well, and I think most of it has to do with the fact that, I mean, you know, people say I was a big cornerstone there. I mean, AJ was TNA.
I agree, the face.
When you thought of TNA, and regardless of what I did or what anybody else did, you thought of AJ Styles. And, I mean, he was diehard TNA. I mean, he was, born and died in the wool over there. When he left, from a personal standpoint, being a really good friend of mine, I mean, he was in my wedding party, and you know, he's a brother to me, and he's still, I mean, even after he left, it was just like,
of course,
going back and forth, and I was shocked. I was like, I couldn't understand, you know, how they couldn't have figured that out, because I mean, he was always their guy.
How they could let him go?
Yeah, yeah. And but you know, at the same time, I also understood that that's the nature of wrestling, and people come and go, and.
Was it kind of a blow to the morale of the company when
it was? Because I mean, it'd be different if AJ wasn't universally liked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if AJ was like some guy, well, you know, he's gone, but he was an asshole. Like, no, everybody loved AJ, and everybody loved working with him. I think is another big thing too, is that, and he always delivered. I mean, there isn't a match that AJ didn't go in there, and if, you know, if he had a crack at it, and there wasn't a bunch of craziness that involved it, that he didn't go in there and absolutely murder it. So I mean, that I think anytime you lose somebody like that, yeah, it's a huge blow.
Did you enjoy doing? You mentioned before talking about like kind of a high flying style, which you're very agile and you can do that. I didn't really. I'm not gonna say I didn't like it, but I didn't like the concept of Samoa Joe being in the X division. You know, which is kind of the. It's not cruiserweight or junior heavyweight, but it's more of the high flying, you know, type of a thing. I kind of felt they just put you in there because it was like, something different. Put him in here, but I didn't really see you climbing. You know,
no, I don't
rafters
go over,
and
I don't go to that top rope ever.
That's what I mean.
It's horrible. Were
you cool with that, or did you?
I was cool with it because of the people I was working with.
Oh, AJ.
And... Yeah, but I have a couple theories on that. I think one is that they at the time, and you'll see it a lot when they're talking about, they didn't want to make the X Division be about just being a cruiserweight.
Oh, okay.
They really wanted it to mean like, oh, this crazy kind of hybrid whack.
More of a style than a weight class.
Style than a weight class.
Gotcha.
And so I was kind of the counterbalance to, because everybody else was really flying and doing stuff in there. So I was to be the measured counterbalance to that. And I was to be the great, you know, evil foil to these, you know, young, sparky, high-flying guys.
Sparky.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I was that guy. I was
giving 100% in the ring with all these wonderful fans.
You know, pump.
Exactly,
the crowd. No good. You know, and I was supposed to be kind of like the counterbalance to that. You know, the big, evil, gargantuan that needs to be surmounted. And in some other aspects later on, I think I was put there to kind of keep me out of the heavyweight title picture, because there was guys there that they wanted to have a defined heavyweight style, and they didn't want me kind of up there at the time, especially in the early days. And I have no problem saying this. They did not want me up in the heavyweight division yet, because they had a set kind of entrenched group of guys.
Who was in that group at that point?
You know, like Jeff.
Jarrett.
Jarrett and whoever he had, you know, working with him at the time.
Gotcha.
And, you know, and I mean, no ill will. I mean, I think stylistically they wanted that delineation between.
Lighten up, brother.
Yeah. That kid's crazy. We don't want him in here. Good Lord.
Exactly. Take that muscle buster. Forget that.
Yeah. Do you see him kicking people? What is his problem?
Yeah. So they kind of put you in the X Division to be with those guys instead. Right.
Yeah. And I was, you know, I think they thought I was kind of an unpredictable hothead at the time too, which I wasn't, but you know, that was kind of the mantra that was put on.
So. How was your experiences with Vince Russo? Do you think he helped the company? Do you think it was a?
It's funny. It's been kind of always my initial, interaction with Russo were always real good, even through my time there. I didn't agree with some of the things that he came up with, but you know, at the same time, I always believe in working with a guy, and that, you know, good things don't happen if you're complete. Like if I would have said, oh, this is horrible, blah, 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 made a big stink. I wouldn't have won that battle, especially at the time. And B, then it was guaranteed to be a fail. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, I did what I could to work with him. it was funny when he initially left TNA at the time. You know, he kind of went out and did this interview, and you know, somebody asked him about, you know, missed opportunities with me, and he kind of trashed me. You know, like,
in what way?
Just like saying that it was my fault and that I wasn't motivating all this stuff. And you know, and I never made a point of ever saying anything, you know, bad about him. I mean, he takes enough heat, and I think sometimes he was used as a shield for other people's booking.
How do you mean?
There was one time there was like this coffin match or something like that, and people were chanting "Fire Russo," and he had and he had nothing to do with the angle.
Gotcha.
Nothing. But you know, he was used that. But since you know he had this reputation in WCW, he was kind of used at this.
He's the scapegoat.
He's the scapegoat. You know, and I think and I can't really. There was a few other ones I can't really, you know, remember over the years that I remember people were putting heat on him about, and I'm like. And I knew for a fact he had nothing to do with booking any of it. But the people who did were more than happy to be like, oh, don't worry about it. Vince, you had nothing to do with that. But, you know, yeah, don't ever chant his name. That's all I care about. You know,
if they like it, it's my idea. If they hate it, it's Russo's.
Yeah, it's Russo's idea. And I think a lot of times he kind of was used in that role. And I think a lot of times he didn't do things that were, you know, always the best or didn't work out the way he thought they did. And, I mean, but minor's good. So then, you know, he kind of went out and kind of did something to trash me a little bit. And, you know, it took me by surprise because we did have this good, despite of whatever I felt or disagreed with him about, we had a good, you know,
rapport,
you know, and, you know, when I think I was talking to Carlos, you know, Conan, and, you know, Conan immediately, here's the shovel can, let's go. And I'm always like, you know, and I love him, you know, but that's his thing. He loves to stir,
brother,
get the pot stirred.
Did
but
you hear what Russo said about you, bro?
Russo said about
we're,
you,
we're
bro.
Moving our heads back and forth like Stevie Wonder. That's a Conan.
Yeah, the best Carlos promos always start with him shaking his head no.
Shaking back and
let
forth.
Let me tell you, bro. Like, you know, and I was like, man, you know, whatever, man, screw him, whatever, you know. And then, of course, I get an email right away from Vince. Brother, I thought we were good, or that we were cool, and I laid out for him. I said, dude, you said this and this and this, and, you know, I really appreciate that. I thought we had a good rapport, too, but, you know.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he totally had kind of put that out of his mind, because I was just fired, then I was angry, and I'm sorry.
But I was fired.
By the way, he emailed me, but you automatically read Vince's emails in his accent.
In his voice, yeah.
Bro, I was sorry. They fired me. I was out of my head at the time. It was cool. And
I was out of my head at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
He talks like that a lot.
So, I mean, like, you know, and I'm always willing to forgive, dude. You know, if you're willing to come forth and address the situation to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's another big thing I'm about is, like, if I got a beef with somebody, like, I hate dudes who take it public first. Like, I'll take the beef to you.
Right.
And
it's between you and me, not between me and Twitter.
Yeah, and that's right? I have a huge issue with some of these cats who take their beef to Twitter before they, because I think it's kind of cowardly in a way, you know. Like,
it's really bitchy.
Yeah, it is. I hate that. Like, you know, I don't have enough courage to bring this opinion to you myself.
Right.
So I'll take this opinion and try to get some public support behind it.
Yeah.
I'll take my version of my opinion and then I'll bring it to you. You know, it's like, nah, just bring it straight to the dude. So I mean, I appreciate the fact that he came to me direct even after everything, and he said what he said, and yeah, we're cool, man. And I hope he's doing
well. I mean, it is a crazy business, and sometimes you say something. I mean, we're around each other all the time, working with each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You're not always going to be friends
with
everybody.
No,
all the time.
And even your best friends in the world, you're going to get in some massive
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You're going to say stupid things or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know? And, how about this past summer when the whole company of TNA was off for a while?
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, you have a contract. You can't leave. Mm-hmm. So were you guys working at all? Like between, I guess I'm talking about between the television deals when the Spike thing kind of ran out before the Destination America thing happened.
I know that they had taken off. Like, you know, obviously they had exclusivity restrictions on some guys. And I know by that time they had taken all those off. Most of the talent, because they understood, you know, guys still need to,
you know,
some guys were on draw deals, whatever. I wasn't on a draw deal. I was on a really pretty ironclad deal. So I was relatively
as
okay.
Far as getting a weekly guarantee.
Yeah, yeah,
sort of
yeah.
Thing,
so like I was okay, but, you know,
so did you work at all during that time or you just kind of hung out at home?
I kind of hung out, you know,
it was
like
3 months or something.
Yeah. And like in this period, you know, like I'm not just waiting for an answer. I'm sending out my network of informants to find out what's going on. So, I think within like maybe 2 months after that, like, you know, somebody kind of said, well, there are some hits certain places and I think you guys are going to end up switching networks. But
how did you feel about that?
A little apprehensive because Spike's, you know, Spike's a big network, man.
Right.
And it's got great penetration, you know, across the country. And, you know, it's like, you know, you always wonder. And I knew that, you know, the people that they're recording probably didn't have the best penetration, but they do have a good media family behind them, kind of like Viacom. So that being the Discovery Network. So, I mean, it was just, it was nerve wracking in the sense that, you know, I wanted things to work out. But I know, you know, other people, they were kind of, you know, they were really, really hurting at the time, you know.
But your contract was nearing its end at that point in time.
Yeah.
Did that kind of tell you, like, maybe it's time for me to move on? Or were you still willing to stay?
That was kind of one of the initial kind of signals. Because, you know, and I don't mean to cast disparagement on them. Because
no.
I really, really want them to succeed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I never bury TNA.
And it's good for us. And you know as well as I do, it's good for the industry. You know,
absolutely. And for the boys.
Yes.
And for the fans.
It is. And for the fans. Yeah. So, you know, I knew seeing that, I was kind of like, it was kind of like, it's like, well, you know, for me, it kind of hurt because, like I said, we did build a ton when it came to the company. And to, you know, kind of see it take a step back to take a couple of steps forward, hopefully.
Right.
You know, it was kind of a blow. You know, you can only hear so many rah-rah speeches.
We're going to
take over the world again. And you know, I'd done 9 years of that. And it was like, man, yeah, this is where we're at. You know, I really hope, you know, this is a good move.
It's funny. When Bubba did this thing this year at the Royal Rumble, he came out and did the appearance. And I was like, how was it? He's like, oh my God. It was like just to be in front of an arena crowd. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. Because I know you guys had, or you guys, TNA had arena crowds in the UK especially. Mm-hmm. But in the States, it was a lot of Orlando studios.
Studio audiences and stuff like that. I mean, and you know, over the period too, I mean, we'd had some great arena crowds for pay-per-views and stuff too. But
the
consistency of it wasn't at that level yet by any stretch of the
imagination. So, did you talk to AJ at all when you know about, like, because now it's, you know, he's now the IWGP heavyweight champion in Japan. He's gone and just, he hasn't looked back since he left TNA. He's probably worked more and made more money since he left. Mm-hmm. Was that something you kind of kept an eye on as your contract was coming to an end?
I kept an eye on it, not from that standpoint, like, oh, you know, what are my prospects of making money out there? Because I kept an eye on it because I keep an eye on AJ.
Of course.
But I remember talking to him, and I talked to him after I'd kind of made the decision about the situation, you know, even before the situation. I mean, obviously, you got your boys, and you're like, I don't know, man. You know, I'm kind of going mulling back and forth, seeing what I want to do. But I remember immediately afterwards, he actually called me, and he goes, so you did it? And I said, yeah. He's like, don't worry, you're going to be fine. And I was like, oh, yeah, I figured, man. He's like, all right. And then, like, you know, we use the same booking agent, so it was like, well, I'll have Bill call you in a couple minutes, and then, you know, and he was already trying to set me up and get me going. So, I mean, he's a good brother in that sense.
two questions on reactions. What was Dixie's reaction when you told her you were going to leave?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the reaction been since you left, as far as, you know, bookings?
Dixie was a bit shocked and disappointed, you know, obviously. You know, I'm very disappointed in your decision, I believe, is, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Well, but she's an emotional being, and, you know, she does care, and she does, and I've been there, and you know, I consider, you know, a lot of the guys there family, and
of course
we've been a family.
Well, been your boss for 9 years too.
Yeah. And it's been a good relationship. That's the thing I think a lot of people overlook, is that, you know, no matter how you feel creatively, if the business relationship's good, and between me and TNA, the business relationship had been stellar for the past 9 years. So, I never falter for that. You know what I mean? And she's done tremendous things for me in my life and my career. And
you always hear nice stuff about her. I've never heard anybody say that she's,
yeah, who know her personally, you
mean,
know,
or a bad boss or whatever. Yeah.
So, I mean, she was disappointed that I'm not going to be around. And, you know, the reaction since then, I mean, you know, like I said, it's really amicable. You know, I mean, I made a point not to leave in a manner that was really, you know, slash and burn. And
it's very classy. Yeah.
Well, and I think in today's kind of media environment, there's just such an easy way to just kind of go out there and immediately get on your Twitter.
Well, once again, go on Twitter to bash people or talk shit or whatever. I mean, it's nobody's business.
And then it's funny, because, like, you do that, you do exit, and you try to have some kind of sense of decorum with it. And then people are like, oh, you're just not trying to burn a bridge.
Oh, my gosh.
No, it's just, it's, I genuinely wish them well, you know, like
I appreciate the time I had there, and it's time to move on. Right?
Yes. Yeah. You know,
the thing about that too, is we talked about this earlier in the show today. It's like, if after a year or 2 years or whatever, you wanted to go back there? How huge would it be if Samoa Joe came back? You know, that's the thing. Like, when you leave a place, it shouldn't be in a bad way, because it could work out again. Or even if it doesn't, you always want to leave that bridge unburned.
Yeah. And you know, it's like an example of this is Ring of Honor. You know, when I left Ring of Honor, you know, I gave them plenty of a notice beforehand,
right,
and then I did everything I could. And I walked back in there in Vegas, and, you know, the response from the crowd was incredible and crazy and just kind of like, you know, self-fulfilling in its own way. But walking in the back and just seeing all the wrestlers there and just being embraced and like, oh God, so glad you're back. And
yeah,
like, you know, you don't get that a lot in wrestling, you know, guys saying so glad you're back, you know? So,
is there a lot of the same guys there in Ring of Honor from when you
left? No, a lot of new guys.
I guess there would have to be for nine years.
Yeah. There's some staples there that always be there, you know, and guys who've kind of moved on and moved up in the company and are doing different things.
Is it the same boss?
No. Okay, completely new company, Sinclair Broadcast Group.
Right.
They bought out from Kerry Silken. Kerry Silken's still there as an advisor. I mean, he was one of the first I walked the door, gave me a big hug, and he's like, oh, I'm so glad you're back. And, you know,
but they snapped you up right away, because we were going to do this yesterday, but then you called me last week and said, I took this booking. So,
yeah.
Were they like, Joey, we got this show, come on down.
Yeah. And you know, I'm booked with them through, you know, for about five more shows here for the next couple of months. So,
Are you going back to Japan? Is that another option for you?
We're in talks, like the Japan stuff and a few other places. We're still talking.
I can see AJ flipping out trying to get you there.
Yeah, and I have a good relationship with New Japan. You know, like, I worked for Inoki office out in LA, and we ran his dojo up in Santa Monica. And you know, the office knows me. Tiger, you know, he knows me. And
Tiger Tori?
Yeah, Tiger Tori.
Son of a bitch.
That son of a bitch.
He's a great guy, man. He's a real ball buster too.
Oh yeah, yeah. You can't get one over on him. Yeah,
so you can't even pronounce your words properly. Shut your mouth.
Oh, shut my mouth. And then he'll cuss you out in New York accent. It's awesome.
He used to call Eddie Guerrero, you look like Mexican flamingo. What do you mean? Big body, skinny leg.
Yeah, don't care.
Stupid little ponytail. But I mean, we were talking about that, how for example, you know, AJ is now the champion there. Mm-hmm. That, I think it's his second time. And I believe there's only two or three other foreigners ever to be multiple
time
IWGP champions, heavyweight champion. Yeah. That's a huge, huge thing.
Huge.
They don't take that lightly there.
No, they don't. Not at all.
You know, and like you said, I mean, you guys have great matches and similar styles. And plus, you're cut out for that Japanese style. And you have the Japanese classic build, too. Just big. You know, I'm big, boy.
Big and mean.
Oh, you're big. What do you think, as we're getting ready to wind down, as far as... Ring of Honor having a chance to be the viable second biggest company in the States? Is it something that like people say all the time about Ring of Honor is probably as big as TNA? Is it, or is it still kind of growing?
It's still growing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair criticism, because, you know, they don't have the media penetration. You know, if you just look at the logistics of it all,
right,
that, you know, TNA has, they don't have the international presence that TNA has built over the years. But that being said, I mean, watching that pay-per-view last week, I mean, the product is just still, you know, and you leaving a company, always come back, you always kind of like hear things like, oh, it's not the same. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And I went to that show the other night, and I was just like, I was blown away, man. I mean, just a lot of those same type of guys when I was coming up, they're just young, hungry, have really, really creative minds and great ideas. And you know, it just takes a little bit of focus and the focus and the energy, and it could be really, really dangerous. Turn into a laser, you know.
Were the fans excited to see you?
Yeah. And
did they know you're going to be there?
They did announce it like shortly before I got there. So, yeah, it wasn't that much of a surprise.
So, who are some of the guys that you're looking forward to working with in Ring of Honor?
In general, you know, the Briscoes again. I think they're great. There's a few other guys there that are. You know, they kind of give. There's a Warbeard Hansen guy. I mean, he looks like a Viking.
Warbeard Hansen.
Yeah,
love the name.
Hansen's his name. But, you know,
I love Warbeard.
Yeah. Oh, big beard. He looks like he should be carrying a battle axe to the ring. You know, like a big dude.
Is Del Rio working there?
Del Rio is. I'd love to work with Del match. Rio.
He is a good worker, man.
Oh man,
I give him so much thumbs up, and I rate him huge.
And you hear that about Lucha guys all the time. You know, like the tremendous agility. But he's one of those guys that's big, you know, legitimately like a taller guy, but I mean, just moves like a cat, is real, so slick with the arm work and stuff.
And he works, and I'm saying this in a positive way, and you'll get this, he works stiff.
Yeah.
Which for me, and I know just from watching you like it too, it's like you feel like you're in a contest. Not not careless.
No.
But stiff. Like you,
he's in there.
You
he's
feel
tight.
It, man.
He's in there. He's
tight.
Physical,
yeah, those kicks to the head. You're like, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
It's like wakes you up a bit.
It does.
Know?
It does. And it amps you. You kind of, oh, okay, now it's going. Let's go. You
I
know,
love so. That style. Yeah. You'll have good matches with him.
Yeah, man.
That's
so
cool. So the classic final question, what's some of your favorite matches that you've ever had in your career?
My stock answer, and I do. I haven't had it yet. But, I mean, my favorite
you haven't
ones.
Had it yet. Well, sure. Yeah. But the ones that you have had.
But the ones I have had. I mean, the three with me, Chris, and AJ at Unbreakable. Was
that for the title?
Yeah, I think for the X Division belt. And
that was a classic. Yeah,
yeah, that one I always love. You know, me and Kobashi. I mean, I really like that one. I go back and I pick it apart. I'm like, we should have done this and this. I'm horrible. I do it with all my matches. That's really why I can't pick a favorite, is because everyone that it's a favorite of mine, I can go back and go like, it's horrible. Look, why did I do that? Oh, that's why that was stupid, you know? But that one, Kobashi, working with Kurt, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, some of my stuff with Brian Danielson in my early ROH days.
He's
or
great too.
Daniel Bryan, excuse
me. Yeah.
I mean, he's
funny. Everyone calls him Dan in the locker room.
But he's another guy that, like, you know, for all the success he's had, it's well deserved, because he's just, I mean, just phenomenal.
Amazing.
Out of the ring.
You know, it's interesting too. You mentioned watching your matches back. Some of my, I think, when I say, people ask me, what's the favorite match you ever have? I always say it's me and Shawn Michaels' ladder match, 2008. I think it was called Unforgiven.
Mm-hmm.
I've never watched it back.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch it back.
Because you don't want to ruin it, right?
No, I remember it up here in my head.
Yeah.
And in my head, it's a perfect match.
Yeah.
So I don't need to pick apart, like, I should have chopped him there, or why did I do that, or that looked, you know.
And I would do that, and I do that when I go.
Yeah.
Like, I avoid watching some of those matches back, because people are like, it's such a great response, and, like, you know, if it's kind of, I get this overwhelming, like, positive, that's not just blowing smoke.
Yeah.
Then I will purposely go out of my way not to watch it, just so I won't ruin it in my head. Because I'm just like, no, it wasn't a perfect match.
Yeah, and then sometimes there'll be ones that you think were just the shits, and you won't watch it, but then sometimes if you by chance have to happen to watch it back, you're like, well, that wasn't so bad at all.
I thought that was way worse.
Like, what was my problem with that?
Yeah.
You know?
I threw a coffee cup over that match. That was
ridiculous. Exactly. Yeah. I cried for days on that.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you, man.
All right. Amazing conversation with Samoa Joe. And I just want to add, as we were leaving, I asked him, do you have any intentions of going to the WWE? And it's something that we didn't want to talk too much about on the show, but he said he wanted me to tell you guys that there have been interactions between Samoa Joe and the WWE, and there's some negotiations going on. So we're not sure exactly what's going to happen, but he is in talks with the WWE right now. And I know this for sure. A few years ago, I was talking to Triple H, and Joe's name came up, and he was saying how much he enjoyed Joe's work and how much of a fan he is of Samoa Joe and of all of his wrestling style. So you never know what's going to happen. Keep your eyes open. You could be seeing Joe in the WWE very soon, but if not, he will be at Ring of Honor. You can find out all of his matches upcoming. You do not want to miss the return of the killer kick-ass Samoa Joe. Joe is going to kill you. Joe is going to kill you. Yeah, he's going to get you, and he's coming. And hey, if you live in Los Angeles, you should also be going to see the Resurrection of Jake the Snake. It's the documentary that's sweeping the nation, winning awards, playing a special screening at the Arclight Theater on Sunset Boulevard this Sunday, March 8th at 8 p.m. Still a few tickets available. That's not some kind of a shill or some kind of a selling point. It has been moved from the small venue to the bigger venue because so many tickets have been sold. You need to check out the story about how Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga literally saved Jake's life, literally saved Scott Hall's life. It's an amazing, amazing documentary. Once again, at the Arclight Theater on Sunset Boulevard this Sunday, March 8th at 8 p.m. If you live in L.A., go check it out. And if you live in England, Ireland, Scotland, France, Switzerland, Germany, you got to come rock with us at the Cinderblock Party World Tour. It's underway. We're here. We're ready to rock. We just killed it in Ireland, in Belfast, and then in Cork. The shows in Ireland have been killer. We love Ireland. And tonight, we continue our Irish stand, rocking it in Dublin. What's the old joke? Are you Irish because my penis is Dublin? No, wait. Are you from Ireland? Well, maybe I am. Why? Because I've been looking at you and my penis is Dublin. That's a pickup line that will work for sure. Not. Remember that? Not. Yeah, probably one of the worst pickup lines I've ever heard in my life, but it makes me laugh. My penis is Dublin. That's funny. Go try that on the ladies and see what happens, guys. Give me the report at Talk is Jericho. Also, give me the report about what you think about the Fozzy tour. If you come to the shows, like I said, Dublin tonight makes me laugh every time. Tomorrow, heading over the pond to England, Nottingham on the 7th, Rock City, one of my favorite places. March 8th in Wolverhampton, the Slade Rooms, not to be confused with Chris Slade, who's now the drummer from AC/DC and a Talk is Jericho alumni. Have to get him on the show again. March 9th, Manchester. March 10th, Glasgow, Scotland. Always a crazy, crazy night. These are crazy, 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 crazy nights whenever we do a tour. March 11th in London, 12th Bristol, 13th Exeter, 14th Southampton, 15th in Brighton. Going to be hanging out there with the Iron Maiden manager, Rod Smallwood, the man behind Iron Maiden. He lives in Brighton. He will be there. Then we head over to Paris, France, Paris, March 17th. Very, very excited. Je t'aime Paris. March 18th, Pratteln, Switzerland. Switzerland, home of Cesaro. Like I say that, like it's a very, what a generic xenophobic thing to say. Oh, Switzerland. Yeah, that's the home of Cesaro. There's like 18,000 cities in Switzerland, but it's Pratteln that we're going to. And then we hit Germany for three shows, Munich, Mannheim, and Bochum. The tour is selling well. We are selling out. Belfast sold out. Cork was jam-packed. Listen, you want to come to the show, don't miss it. Don't be one of those people that's like, hey, did you go to Fozzy last night? No, I didn't go. How was it? It was amazing. Oh, you missed out. You're so nerd. You're so crazy. And people will pants you and they'll haze you and throw things at you. Don't be that guy. Go to see Fozzy and go to FozzyRock.com for all information on tickets and for VIP packages. We have the greatest VIP experience in the world. Come hang out with us. I'll buy you a sandwich. I will. All right. Thank you so much once again for checking out the show. I love doing this for you for free for twice a week. And thanks to Amazon for helping me keep the ball rolling, keep the wheels greased. You go to podcastone.com. You click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. You click on Talk is Jericho. You see all them Amazon links and you shop. You just shop. That's all you got to do. And every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show. So we keep doing this for free for a week. No hidden fees or hidden charges. No extra charges. You're just getting that shopping done. You're helping me out in the process. All right. Very, very excited. Another fine episode of Talk is Jericho. And you are here. You're making it happen. And we'll see you next week. But in the meantime and in between time, you stay hard. You stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And next week, we got another guy who took control of his own destiny, wasn't happy with what he was doing, and left. We're talking about Justin Gabriel, who left the WWE. He quit the WWE. He said, I can't take it anymore. Enough is enough. Time for a change. I'm mad as hell and ain't going to take it anymore. And left the WWE. As he said, he walked out on his dream. He is now also on the indie scene. He's tearing it up. He's got a lot to offer. He is now called PJ Black. PJ Black is back, baby. And once again, where does he do his interview to tell you why he left the WWE? Right here on Talk is Jericho. You're going to hear that on Wednesday. You are not going to want to miss it. I want you to stay safe. Have a lot of fun. Be cool to your family and your friends. And we'll see you on Wednesday. Yeah, boy. Yeehaw!
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.